going to read my text backwards this morning, not really from the end of the sentence to the beginning, but in terms of the New Testament first and the Old Testament second, because the end of Romans 7 provides a wonderful and all too familiar yo-yo expression of our human condition, whether we are in positions of power or are underdogs of one sort or another. Matt gave me a great setup in his sermon of last week, where all those failings of King Solomon, driven by his fears and hopes and ambitions, show us how little great resources suffice to give us genuine satisfaction or protect us from great evil. Now this morning, I'm going to go at it from the other end, looking at the enslaved subjects of Pharaoh, expected to do exactly what they were told, to submit to another's power or will or authority, with sufficient punishment on the immediate horizon if they didn't. Hear then the word of God, first from the end of chapter 7 of the book of Romans. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am of the flesh, sold into slavery under sin. I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree that the law is good. But in fact, it is no longer I that do it, but sin that dwells within me. For I know that nothing good dwells within me, that is, my flesh. I can will what is right, but I cannot do it. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I do. Now, if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I that do it, but sin that dwells within me. So I find it to be a law that when I want to do what is good, evil lies close at hand. For I delight in the law of God in my inmost self, but I see in my members another law, at war with the law of my mind, making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members. Wretched person that I am, who will rescue me from this body of death? Thanks be to God, through Jesus Christ, our Lord. And then, the latter text, from the first chapters of the book of Exodus, with an omission in the middle, starting with chapter 1, verse 6. Joseph died, and all his brothers, and that whole generation. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Now a new king arose over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase and, in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every boy that is born of the Hebrews you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live." Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine baby, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and plastered it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds on the bank of the river. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, while her attendant walked beside her. Attendants walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid to bring it. When she opened it, she saw the child. He was crying, and she took pity on him. "This must be one of the Hebrews' children," she said. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and she took him as her son. She named him Moses, because, she said, "I drew him out of the water." This is the word of the Lord. This latter text, the Old Testament text, is one that I have not myself taken up for more than 35 years. And I would never have dreamed way back then that it could be at least as wrenchingly, painfully relevant after all this time as it was then. It brought me back actually more than 55 years to the one moment in the one college lecture that sets me back on my heels yet today. The one college moment I hope I shall never forget. We'll get there. But first, let us start with the infant Moses. Afloat, alone, in a carefully crafted little basket on the river. Not exactly where you would generally suppose a baby ought to be. And the question is, how he got there. Now, if you're tempted to answer, well, that's a stupid question. Everybody knows, and the story says plainly, that his mother put him there. Well, then, you haven't quite gotten my meaning. Of course his mother put him there. But that isn't exactly a normal, everyday thing for a mother to do. When you think of Moses and the bulrushes, do you get the same image I have of those old pictures in Sunday school pamphlets where a perfectly secure baby Moses, lying snugly in his little basket, is found by an excited but tenderly smiling Egyptian princess, like a package that has been placed under a Christmas tree just waiting to be discovered in the morning? And they all lived happily ever after. Or so, at least, this episode seems to end. So familiar. So safe. So different from the endless stories in today's newspapers about infants deposited in trash cans or placed in paper bags and left on doorsteps by frightened, indigent, helpless young mothers. And the trouble is, or at least one trouble, the baby on the doorstep is generally a good deal safer than Moses was. Our society, at least presumably, says that foundling babies, whatever gender or race, will at least be minimally protected and nurtured. Egyptian society, on the other hand, in that day, they said that foundling human babies, like all other male Hebrew babies, would be drowned. If, of course, a marauding animal didn't discover such a tasty morsel first, or if the basket didn't spring a leak or have a hole punched into it one way or another. An observing young girl, his sister, wasn't much protection against such threats. as far as anyone could guess, being found meant death, and not being found meant death. Well, we might try to take Pharaoh's point of view. These Hebrew subjects of his, there were so many, sound familiar? So many of them. Were they really quite trustworthy? Useful as slave and agricultural labor, yes. Necessary to the economy, yes. But trustworthy? Well, they'd been in Egypt for a very long time, it's true, and they hadn't done anything very radical yet. But they might. The days of Joseph, Jacob's son, whose wise advice to a previous pharaoh had saved the land from famine, were long gone. The pharaoh had no memory of them and no particular desire to look them up in the record book either. He just looked around him and saw Hebrews everywhere. What if, verse 10, they were to become allies of enemies of Egypt and fight against Egypt? They hadn't yet, you understand, but they might. What if, no, it couldn't be risked. The civilized world had to be kept safe from such threats. Pharaoh was afraid, and he used an alleged threat as the occasion for his own wickedness. He used the same sort of reasoning that tyrants from the beginning of time have used, and many who would not formally be designated as tyrants have used it too. If there is immediate or potential or even imagined danger to something like one's country that one values, whatever is necessary to protect it is automatically justified. And the difference between an imagined and an immediate danger is by no means always clear, especially to those prone to fear. Pretty soon, those strategies that appear advantageous come to be seen as necessary. And from there, it's a short step to anything goes. Not only goes, but is a positive virtue insofar as it supports the goal of increasing one's felt security. So, Pharaoh proceeded from intimidation and forced labor, verses 10 through 14, to genocide, verse 22. He oppressed the Hebrew people shamelessly. Well, it's a well-known psychological fact that the more we wrong others, the more evil we do to them, the more we will hate and despise them, as if we were trying to justify to ourselves having treated them so badly. And hence, the more we will be willing to continue to do to them more and greater wrong in the future. The cycle is a vicious one, vicious in every sense of the word. It has even been postulated way back by Calvin himself that virtually every war in history has its roots in evil steps taken to forestall anticipated dangers, dangers that are not yet incontrovertible. Reactions then set in on both sides until the situation is wholly out of control. Stitch in time may save nine in the domestic realm, and dealing promptly with a small problem before it becomes a large one can only be commended. But that is a very different matter from doing what is intrinsically wrong out of fear. It simply is not true that we ought to protect ourselves by any and every means against every danger we perceive. We haven't learned much on this point since Pharaoh's day, as I hardly need to remark. Note, Pharaoh oppressed the Hebrews to the point of ordering all male children drowned, a handy way of decreasing their numbers. But he didn't do the drowning himself. He just instituted a policy. Policies on paper or stone tablets, as the case may be, appear remarkably sanitary. No blood, no screams, no grief springing off the page. Doing evil at a distance is not at all the same thing as taking a chubby, smiling infant from a desperate mother and casting it in the river yourself. Maybe Pharaoh was a sentimental man. Who knows? Maybe he would have been quite unable actually to do the murders that he ordered. Again, who knows? But ordering them was remarkably easy, hardly even real. For all we know, Pharaoh may have stayed away. It's even reported that Eichmann, upon visiting one of the concentration camps his policy had brought into existence, came away sickened. But he went back to his office and kept signing the papers. It's easy to do evil when we're frightened. It's easy to do evil when we don't see up close the results of what we have done, or when we don't have to act directly to cause harm. It's easy. Big tyrants and little tyrants and ordinary citizens do it every day. Would Moses be afloat on the river if I were Pharaoh? Or if you were? Now, take the point of view of the Egyptian taskmasters, verse 11, or the ordinary Egyptian citizens, verse 22. If they oppressed the Hebrews actively by keeping them in bondage or actually committing the prescribed murders, after all, they were just following orders. Their government told them clearly that these people were dangerous. And they had a pretty good life for themselves, all things considered. They didn't especially want to live under any other government. Shouldn't they believe what they were told? After all, they didn't have all the facts. It wasn't their responsibility to make these judgments. Surely it must be right to believe what they were told to believe and do what they were told to do. Obedience, submission to authority, we value these things. And if the truth were to be told, it's often nice to see someone else as having the final authority. So, we come to that moment in that college lecture that I hope never to forget. I can still, more than 55 years later, see the large lecture hall filled with students and the gifted young professor stalking back and forth across the stage. He was describing a series of experiments of which at that time I had never heard, but the psychologists in the congregation will instantly recognize the famed Milgram experiments. Experiments that changed the face of experimental psychology forever and can no longer be performed, not least because too many people learned too much they didn't want to know about themselves. Allegedly, these were fairly straightforward experiments in learning, specifically on the effects of punishment on learning. Subjects were obtained in the usual way by placing an ad in the newspaper offering people a small sum of money for participating in a scientific study taking place at Yale University. They were ordinary people, people like you and me. The subjects were cast, supposedly but not really by lot, in the role of teachers, and a portly middle-aged man was the learner. The teachers were to administer electric shocks to the learner when he answered questions incorrectly. The teachers were themselves given a low-level shock to get the idea of what it felt like. The learner was strapped into what looked like a sort of electric chair in an adjoining room, while the teacher was seated before a large and impressive shock generator, equipped with a voltage meter and making appropriate buzzes and clicks and hums. It had a row of switches labeled progressively from 15 volts to 450 volts. They were in groups of four, with the first group labeled slight shock, then moderate shock, and so on, all the way up to danger, severe shock, and then finally a simple and ominous X, X, X. The student wasn't very promising. He made lots of mistakes. And each time, the teacher was instructed to increase the level of shock used as punishment. Soon the subject began to utter a low grunt. Then he shouted in protest. Then he demanded to be released from the experiment. Then he emitted an agonizing scream. And after about 330 volts, nothing more was heard from him at all. But the experimenter simply told the teacher to continue. Having gotten about this far in relating the details of the experiment, my university professor paused, a long, intense pause. He looked out over his class, a class of ordinary people like you and me, and he said, "Look at the person on your left. Look at the person on your right. Two out of three of you would have gone all the way." Two out of three ordinary people went past the grunts, past the scream, past the silence, all the way to XXX, simply because an authority told them to. Now, the learner, of course, was not a real learner. He was an actor, a confederate of the experimenter. No shocks were actually administered except the initial light one to show the teacher what shock feels like. The experiment was not an experiment in learning, but in obedience to authority. An experiment sparked by the seemingly incredible behavior of ordinary German functionaries and ordinary German citizens during World War II. Pretty obviously, Americans, too, are quite willing to do evil when they are ordered to do it. It's easy to do evil when somebody else is taking responsibility for it. We are taught from childhood to obey authority. Surely we are not to blame if we just do what we're told. Well, the Nuremberg trials made it a matter of international law, even as if God's law were not enough, that obeying orders will not do as an excuse for wrongdoing. So what if you had been an Egyptian taskmaster or an Egyptian citizen? What if I had? Would we have supported the policies that resulted in Moses being afloat on the river? Look to your left. Look to your right. Do those folks look okay? Then look to yourself. Remember, never forget, two out of every three of us. Then finally, take the point of view of Moses' mother. The very first thing she did when Moses was born was break the law. Yes, it was a bad law. It was a law so bad it would be absurd even to suppose that any mother would voluntarily keep it, give up her newborn baby boy to be killed by the state. Her disobedience may have been more a matter of maternal instinct than of moral principle. Nonetheless, we do well to note that she is certainly not rebuked by my text for failing to submit to the powers that be. Nor were the Egyptian midwives who did not kill male Hebrew babies as instructed, whose story we passed over this morning, neither were they rebuked by my text. If anything, a bunch of subversive, disobedient women who refuse to do wrong simply because somebody told them to are the heroines of this part of the story. By the world standards, they were as absolutely powerless as anyone could be. But without them, the powerless ones, whatever would have happened to the whole Hebrew nation? Would we even, playing out the story, be here this morning? So often God's plan seems to hang by the thinnest of threads, and the key persons are the last ones we would have imagined. However, the element of refusal to submit to evil authority is not the only aspect of Moses' mother's behavior on which I want to focus. It was necessary, but it was not enough. What was required of her was that she do everything in her power, which wasn't much, and then dare to leave the rest to God. For 3 months, while Moses was still tiny, she succeeded in hiding him, but that obviously couldn't go on forever. No doubt she had to work in the fields like the other Hebrew slaves, and lusty cries of a big, healthy child could not be muffled indefinitely. So looking around her, she marshaled her pet paltry resources, a basket, some bitumen, some pitch. Together they made a little ark that would perhaps keep the baby alive for a few more hours or days. Not long, but one does what one can. A little ark. The word recalls an earlier day when God's purpose was carried out on by a little remnant of his creation, safely afloat in a mighty flood. Do you suppose that that part of her people's history was in Moses' mother's mind as she brought the little basket with her treasure in it down to the river? Do you suppose she remembered and hoped against hope, even as her rational self argued that this was, of course, just one baby, different in no particular way from who knows how many other babies of other devoted mothers who were already gone forever? But do you suppose she remembered and hoped? The letter to the Hebrews, 11:23, says that it was by faith that she had hidden him for those 3 months. And now the time had come when a new action was required. Having done all she could to make her baby secure, she set the basket down and let go and walked away. And you know the rest of the story. But could I have done what she did? Could you? Could we in faith have left Moses afloat on the river? What Pharaoh did was understandable enough, in some ways easy enough, and certainly evil. He did what too many of us do when we are afraid. What the taskmasters and obedient ones from among the people of Egypt did was understandable enough, perhaps distasteful to most, but evil nonetheless. They do what most of us do under orders. What Moses' mother did, well, that's not easy to understand. It must have been difficult beyond all imagining. It required a sort of faith that must have been but the barest flicker of hope pushing through despair. But she took the only course open to her that did not involve doing more evil. Moses, aged 3 months, afloat on the river. Had it been up to you, had it been up to me, how would he have gotten there? What role would we have played? May the good Lord have mercy on us all. Amen.